We're on.
Good. Good morning. Hey, thanks for thank you for doing the video meeting. Really appreciate it. So we have maybe I'll just kick in and start. And we have a few other people that'll be joining us. It's a little bit early here, so I guess it's probably very early over there. First question is, just you had really strong performance in the first quarter. Whether it's the franchise or company-owned stores, mid-teen type of growth. What do you think really drove that outperformance? And the other part is, how sustainable is that? And, obviously you can't get mid-teens for forever, but how sustainable can you drive this very strong comp growth?
Well, as you point out, the first quarter was certainly exceptional, and much as we'd like to keep seeing 14.9s, that's probably a little optimistic over time. But fourth quarter of last year was also double digit, and each of the quarters last year was quite strong. So we've had a pretty good track record that goes all the way back to the end of 2009 when we relaunched the brand. And while many of those quarters were single digit, they were still strong. And we've been getting the strength the right way. It's been coming out of a mixture of very good order count growth for us in our corporate stores and our franchisees, and a little bit of ticket growth. And if we continue to take share from our competitors, one would hope that we can continue to do well.
So is there one, if you were to point to one key driver and how many quarters that would, how many quarters is that going to last for, would you say?
I have no idea how to answer a question that projects our same-store sales growth into the future. I wish I could. But what I can tell you is that when we look at what's driving our business forward, we're looking at a combination of things. We're looking at the fact that we have a menu of food that tastes really good, which is not something we had in 2009 or before. We're looking at the changes in technology that we think have helped set us apart from our competitors, particularly the smaller chains, the regional chains that can't afford to make the investment we are. And our consumers, our particular consumers, really like the technology we're giving them. We've had really good, strong advertising. We had a change in the way that people think about our brand over the last 5 years. To me, those are all the type things that are more indicative of things that you'd like to think are going to help you over the longer term. It's not just because we had a red-hot promotion or that we had a particular new product launch that got us something for a brief period of time.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's much better to have, obviously, for sustainability. As you think about 2000, and I'm going to open it up to the guys here. As you think about 2015 and what you have in the pipeline, some of it you haven't disclosed, and obviously we don't not want to know what that is. But how innovative is that? And how excited are you about the new products relative to last year?
Well, when we get the question about new products, it's always related to food. And we've got food new products that we can launch, and that's good. Last year we launched specialty chicken, and we've done some other things prior to that. But the one thing that I have to point out is, for our consumers and for what we're doing, innovation goes way beyond new products. Innovation can be about voice ordering, where we're the leaders. It can be about anything we're doing with technology. It can be about specific promotions. And the real key is that there's got to be true innovation. It's got to be different, but it doesn't just have to be new products. And when you look at it in the broader sense, I'm not at all worried that this is not an innovative company or that there's not enough innovation. You have to keep the pipeline full of good, interesting things for our customers for a long time.
But having a new chicken product is not, that might help you for a quarter or two, but what you've been talking about are initiatives that are going to help help drive this longer term at very strong comps.
Sure. And occasionally we're going to have to have, we're going to want to have a new product out there, but the real key for us hasn't been, we've done just as well in windows of time in our marketing windows when we're talking about technology or something else that's relevant to the customers as we have with the new products. And as long as that's working for us, that's great, because new products are certainly, while they can add sales and they can be good short term, sometimes they're good longer term with some of the products that we've launched. It's all a positive, and we'll keep doing that. But the real key for us is that we're not forced to launch a new product every 2 months, because that's pretty disruptive to our business. It's disruptive in the stores. We have a lot of other things that are just as relevant to our customers as new product, and we're doing well with that.
Yeah, your technology is a sustainable advantage relative to your competitors versus a product that can be easily replicated. I understand that. In terms of competition, do you think part of the reason for your success are the missteps at Pizza Hut? I mean, Pizza Hut has really had some, you know, they did their launch and it was poor advertising initially. I think it was, poor TV commercials that they had, and they just have done a great job in the relaunch. So how much of your success has to do with that versus just taking share from independents versus other QSR operators?
The best information that we have, and it's always a little bit, a little bit of guessing, but the best information we have is that we continue to take share from the mom and pops and from the regionals. And, certainly in the last 6 months, I'm sure we've taken a little bit of share from Pizza Hut. So I think it's spread out across most of our competition as opposed to just, it certainly isn't just from them.
Burgers or anything else, just making it more convenient for people to order pizza. Do you think that's where part of it's coming from too?
You cut out for a little bit, so if you can repeat the question.
So is it just the pizza guys you're taking share from, or is it just everyone who sells in the fast food, like burgers and other segments? I mean, is it primarily pizza?
It's certainly hard for us to capture, are we getting more occasions from hamburger or anybody else? It's just really hard to measure. What we think is that the pizza industry overall is up a little bit, and that could be indicative of more occasions coming from competition. But to say it's us taking from the burger people today, that's a pretty hard statement to support.
Fair enough. Well, I have more questions, but why don't I open up to some of the guys here as well.
The question on just overall your digital penetration. I think you said the last time it was reached over 50%. Where do you think that level can go? I know some of your markets are north of 60, but from a U.S. perspective, what's your sort of long-term, is there a long-term goal of reaching digital penetration of whatever percentage, and how do you get there?
Well, before I answer, I actually will introduce Jeff Lawrence, who's our treasurer, and has been starting to handle some of our Q&A, and I'm going to let him answer a few questions, starting with this one.
Good morning, everyone. When we think about digital penetration, as you noted, in the U.S. business, we're now 50% of sales kind of on a run rate basis. In the past, that's been increasing about 5 percentage points per year if we walk back. So as we think about going forward and knowing that some of our international partners, as you noted, are in kind of the 60% plus now, but did have a head start on digital compared to our U.S. business. Certainly we think it can grow from where it is today. As far as the ultimate top end, really I don't think anyone really knows how far it will go. I can tell you that, still 10% of our business are people that walk into our stores. So there is a little bit of a cap on that. And then there are some people, including myself, who still do pick up the phone from time to time. Now that we're getting a little older, so I'm less mobile challenged, maybe, as my kids would say. But do we think it can continue to grow? We do. The rate and pace, I think, is still TBD. But I think we're encouraged by the fact, as you noted, that our international partners, including folks that you can follow and learn more about our system. Domino's Pizza Enterprise is based out of Brisbane. They're publicly traded. Domino's Pizza Group out of Milton Keynes, outside of London, publicly traded. I think with some of the things they and some of the other franchisees internationally are doing, I think we're optimistic that we can continue to grow it. Ultimate top end, who knows?
Do you think another question related to that. So I would say, you know, you guys, Papa John's, and some of the other earlier adopters of digital rolled out, I think, 2011, 2010 time frame. And then in the past few years, you've seen a lot of the bigger guys roll out digital, like Taco Bell, McDonald's, and so on. Do you think that has sort of a halo effect to your business as the industry is really migrating towards more digital, more mobile app that has like a benefit, an outsized benefit to the pizza category in general?
You know, I think one thing with digital and specifically mobile is we know that if you're a customer that orders through digital and specifically mobile, you're just a better customer for us. You tend to buy a little more, you're a little bit more satisfied in the customer. And so I think that as consumers generally use more mobile technology to purchase, not only in pizza, but maybe even in the broader QSR, that does continue to grow. I think that's generally a good thing for us, and I think that's a good thing for us because, you know, we have invested, you know, material amounts of money in building what we believe to be a very user-friendly platform, you know, vis-a-vis some of the other competitors out in the broader space. So we think that, you know, broadly speaking, the more that consumers are comfortable ordering QSR and, again, particularly pizza, we think that, you know, is not a bad thing for us.
How long before some of your competitors can catch up? I mean, how sustainable, how many years do you think you can continue to have this advantage versus them?
Well, if you define our competitors as our two, you know, as Papa John's and Pizza Hut, I mean, I think that they're already making big investments, and they're certainly trying to do many of the things that we are. As you look at the smaller competitors, there's a lot that smaller competitors are going to be trying to do. They're going to be trying to set up their ability to do online ordering. They're probably, some will have mobile apps and some will do different things. But there are more things that we can keep doing.
Right.
So even if they catch up to where we are today, if you look at the pipeline of different innovative things that we can do to both attract the customer as well as to gather and use the data that we're getting from this, to really say catch up, that's going to be hard because, it's, you know, I can tell, we have a list of things we want to accomplish over the next 3 years in the e-commerce area, and hopefully we can do them all, and nobody can catch up to that because you have to be where we are today to even get there. So I think truly catching up to us, if you're a small player, is going to be very difficult. Catching up to where we are today, that's certainly more feasible, but it's expensive, you know, to support, the ability to communicate with us on all the different apps and through online and to do all the things we're doing is hard to do if you've only got 100 or 200 stores to spread the cost over.
Did you see a big uptick in your digital penetration, either desktop or mobile in the first quarter?
No, actually, seasonally, we typically see our upticks in the fourth quarter. In the fourth calendar quarter of the year is typically when, if we're going to see an uptick, it happens then. And whether it's got to do with back to school or something, we aren't really sure. But that's usually where we see the biggest upticks.
So Q1 was more of a normalized penetration growth rate. Is right.
Yeah, I don't remember. I don't recall Q1 as being anything special.
Can you talk about some of the? I don't know if you guys have provided this before, but I'm curious to get your sense on. You said the mobile and the digital customer is a much better customer. Can you talk about some of the increases in the average check that you're seeing from mobile versus, you know, over the phone and walk-in? What's the delta there and how has that trended over time?
I think, you know, if we walk back 5 years when OLO and digital was really taking hold for us, you saw a little bit more of a market difference in check size or ticket size between digital and non-digital. You know, over time, and as you'd expect, part of it's just the math problem of now 50% of it is digital. Those have started to converge. I think the more important thing, the ticket size differences, which again isn't that material right now, is really again that if you are a digital customer compared to a non-digital customer, we know that you have a higher customer satisfaction. We know that you will reorder from us at a higher rate and pace than a non-digital. So what we know is that the more that we can push people from non-digital to a digital customer, that is green lights for us all the way down on pretty much every metric that we care about. So it's really not necessarily just about ticket size. It's about all those other things that are good for the brand.
Are you guys able to, quantify or frame how much better a, over the course of a year, a digital customer is than a offline?
We haven't framed it up, but we have said, if you take a sample, it's very clear. If you do take a sample of customers that were dealing with us by telephone and you track them after they use either an app or go online for the first time, and then you look at their behavior that you can capture after that, it definitely has gone up. We have not quantified that, and I'm sure it changes over time.
Going back to your comp last quarter, can you just kind of help kind of piece apart on kind of different dimensions? Like, did you still experience growth in offline ordering, and how did that compare to the overall comp? Did certain product platforms perform better than others? As an example,
We know that in the first quarter, we had a number of things that worked well. Our advertising, where we talked about the fact that we were not just Domino's Pizza, but we're now Domino's. And we had an ad campaign that supported that as well as supported the idea of buying a variety of products besides pizza. I mean, that's the message, is we're not just a pizza company. That worked. I mean, we certainly were selling, a little more of the pastas and the sandwiches and the side items. That happens anytime we run a promotion that's five different products at $5.99. If you buy two or more, you typically spread that product. You spread your purchases over a wider variety of items on the menu, and that happened. It was also advertising that I think resonated very well with the customers. Technology considered to be was good, just like it had been. We've got a lot of questions in the first quarter about weather, and the fact is we think weather probably had less positive impact on us in Q1 than it did the year before. If anything, it was flat to negative for Q1, so it wasn't about that. We frequently have tried to actually piece together why do we think we did this last year versus this year. And as much effort as went into that in Q1, we still wound up with a big piece of it just saying, wow, we have positive momentum. And it started last year, and it was rolling in the fourth quarter and first quarter. It's really hard to parse it all out.
Till next year when we ask you why your comps. Because they can
I'm sure it's fair to say that the marketing people already have sweaty palms about match a lasting 14.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good problem. When did you install the historically ordered and the saved orders on your option on the app and mobile ordering? That makes sense. So the historical orders that the customer may have on an app, and did that drive same store sales?
So the profiles is one of the innovations that, our IT team was able to deliver for the brand, which, again, is you go in, you put in your credit card information, which is tokenized, and you put in, your address, and you also put in, your favorite couple orders that you can then later choose from, whether you push the easy order button or even the technology knows what your last couple orders are, just in case they were different. That technology, continues to grow at a pretty rapid pace for us over the last, 12 to 18 months or so. And, again, to Mike's point, how much of, doing a 14 is specifically, parsed out to be the positive effects of profiles, very hard to tell. Although we do think it is a feature that's important to us. We think as our customers continue to adopt it, it will hopefully continue to make, more loyal customers out of those folks that, again, not only are going to digital, but are taking that extra step to input some information about themselves. And, again, we know that when they do that, their ordering experience, it can be as simple as 4 or 5 clicks on the run, a lot easier on the mobile technology platform. So that's something that we're excited about longer term.
Do you guys mind giving us, to the extent you can, a sense of or examples of the types of technology innovation you guys are going to have over the next kind of 1-2 years? Maybe preview anything that's in the pipe?
That we typically stay away from because of the fact that it's marketing information, that we're not trying to headline anything for our competition.
Gotcha. How much of it is, how much more exploitation of the data do you guys have in front of you?
We have a lot more opportunity to use the data. I think we're doing a pretty good job in some areas of looking at our customers, learning from our customers. But, I'll give you one to answer the first question. If you say using that data and going back to exploit that with one-on-one marketing, are we really good yet? We're not as good as we could be. Yes, we'll tell you what your past orders were, but we're going to get better about what should we upsell you. And that's how you use the data. We've got a ways to go yet.
One other thing I'd add to what Mike just said is, I think one of the positives about our business is we have a proprietary point of sale system, which is in 100% penetration in the U.S. market. So every corporate owned store, every franchise store has that, it's kind of vertically integrated. On all the e-commerce stuff, we've also largely, developed that in-house. So I think that when we do roll out innovations around technology and digital, I think because a lot of that kind of is in this building here in Michigan, the speed at which we're able to move, might be a little quicker than some folks would otherwise think. So to the extent that there is something out there that we have to react to or something that, we do that forces other folks to react to, I think we're set up kind of organizationally to where we can move at a pretty decent rate and pace around technology.
Is there anything else that, the big benefits of having your own system, pulse, and the speed of getting the platforms rolled out, getting more innovation, is there any other advantages or disadvantages between using a proprietary system or using a third-party system in your view?
For us, it wasn't a big choice at the time we did this because most of the third-party systems that are out there for restaurants had actually been developed for restaurants, as opposed to specifically being developed for a delivery company. And that's the big advantage for us, is we built it with the idea that we can deliver, so it's got a lot more of the features that made sense for us than anything that was available off the shelf plus some tailoring. And that's what drove us in the direction that we went to. So we certainly have built features in that are appropriate to our specific business.
Maybe on international, and we can always go back to digital, which is, really critical for your business. But can you maybe talk a little bit about some of the up-and-coming markets that you think have nice potential? And then also, I think Pizza Hut is introducing greater value. Is that going to start a price war between you and them?
Well, so two separate questions there. I'll take the international, and then I'll kick it back to Mike for any price war commentary. on the international side, harder for us to kind of give you the forward looking on who will grow more in our international markets. I think one of the benefits that we have at Domino's is, we're in 75 markets around the world, and there's no one particular market that, we are so locked into that if they're flat or if they're down a point, is going to affect hopefully the overall same-store sales picture for us. We have good geographic diversification. We have good, I think, developed versus emerging market diversification. So I think that plays well for us longer term. As far as the unit growth, I'll kind of, just point to what has been going on. And again, pointing to, more than half of our international system, master franchise system, is held by four publicly traded companies. Again, the two I mentioned earlier, the one out of Australia and London, and then Alsea out of Mexico City and Jubilant Foodworks out of New Delhi, India. So following them can give you a pretty good sense of where we're going in the international realm. But, from store count perspective, you've seen that, India, for example, has been a fantastic story for us, one that did not happen overnight. We planted a lot of seeds a long time ago and kind of worked through the early stage of an emerging market, pizza industry in that particular location. But, they opened up, I think, in their fiscal year, almost three stores a week on average, which is just fantastic growth for us. I think you've seen some of the other countries around the world, and again, I'll just mention the ones that are publicly held, and you can get their own data from their reports. But you see Japan kind of coming to life and starting to put up some units now under the Australians' ownership. The UK continues to put up some decent store growth numbers. So again, I think just a nice diversified portfolio of store growth, not really dependent on one particular geography. And again, going forward, I hope that's what we'll see kind of in the future.
Your question as to pricing of us versus Pizza Hut, but that value has never gone away as being something that's important to consumers in the pizza industry. It's always been somewhat price competitive. Our pricing reflects what we know is acceptable to our customers. We haven't seen... as you can see from what happened in Q4 and Q1, in both quarters, our ticket went up a little bit while we were growing our order count. So we certainly haven't, been anything that would be the indicators of any kind of aggressive pricing that's driving our business. I don't know how far, I don't know what they will do. Time will tell us that. But I think at this point, we always have gone with a viewpoint that our consumer, we've got to price to our consumer with what's acceptable to them. We've been trying to do that, and it's been working for us.
What are you seeing competitively internationally as well? So who are your, Pizza Hut is a big competitor, but I guess that they may not, maybe it's the pizza category is still much more or less mature, so you're probably taking it from other operators in those markets. Would that be the case? Like, who are your primary competitors internationally?
Well, Pizza Hut's the lead competitor outside the United States, and they are present in almost every country that we would go to. So we're competing against them, sometimes in the form of a delivery carryout store, sometimes in the form of a regular restaurant. But they're there, and we compete against them everywhere. Otherwise, it's more likely to be a Papa John's or a Telepizza, who's big in Spain, or a large local competitor. And when we do things right, when we do them our way, we do a good job in most countries, we can compete very well against that. But as we've been growing very rapidly, a lot of this is not because of share gains. Some of it has been. But, more of this in many of the countries is because the rate of growth of the pizza category is much faster than it is in the United States. And we're either getting our fair share based on what current market share is or our share plus. And that's working out well.
Just talk about opportunity in China long term, and how many units do you see building there today? You have a small presence today. Why has it been taking so long? What are the learnings you've had in the past?
You know, we've been in China and had a presence in China fairly small since, you know, the late 90s. About 4 or 5 years ago, we managed to do a transition with our local master franchise partner there. We think we found, you know, a very capable, again, on the ground local partner that can help us grow our brand. You know, we're now about 50 stores, not quite to 100 yet in China. But the, you know, the positives there are a couple things. It's one where I would actually, you know, thank Pizza Hut for kind of helping to educate the local consumer as they've kind of drafted behind the KFC success story of the last 20 years, obviously with advantages of distribution, marketing, technology, things like that. So I think you're taking, you know, primarily a non-bread, non-dairy culture, educating them about the product. We've seen this in some of our other Asian markets. I think now what we're doing is, you know, we do have the right partner. The store level economics on the ground are improving. You know, longer term, do we believe we can have a much larger presence in China? We do. How much larger? You know, who knows? I think you can look toward, you know, other penetration type stats, whether it's stores for urban population and some of the other places where we are further ahead on the growth curve. And you can start to think a little bit about what might be possible. But again, you know, is it going to get bigger for us? We believe so. How much bigger? Again, I think that's a longer term question, but we do believe we have the right partner in place there. On the ground, you know, details are all trending positively. So, we're going to continue to work really hard with them to grow the brand in China.
Who's the partner in China?
It's a company called, Dash Brands, D-A-S-H Brands. They were formerly an on-the-ground Subway franchisee. Again, very local, very capable, and have been a good partner for us kind of in the early stages of the growth here.
And those units on the ground there, are they more delivery-oriented or more like Pizza Hut, it's more dine-in, casual dining-oriented?
Yeah, good question. You know, it's I think Mike has said this before, you know, when you go into a market that's not very pizza-oriented or you have to educate the consumer, you know, I'd probably rather have a sit-down restaurant in the early stages of a pizza market. I'll tell you that once it gets going and, you know, the need for convenience increases over time, things like that, I would definitely rather have our model, which is a delivery and carry-out focus. So in China, we have stayed true to the delivery and carry-out focus. It doesn't mean that we don't have some additional seating in some of the restaurants up front, but I would definitely characterize that as kind of a carry-in experience, not a dine-in experience. So we're not doing take service and adding some of those complexities to the model. And I think, again, longer term, I think that will be the right model as it's proven to be in so many other markets that have gone through similar growth curves.
Just a question on your corporate tax rate. You guys have a big international presence. Just curious why is it sort of in the high 30s? Some of your competitors are much lower with similar international master franchisee profiles. So just talk a little bit about that.
Well, if they're, you know, there's two ways that restaurant companies typically have a lower tax rate. One is that they actually have foreign operations where you can pay lower tax rates and claim permanent reinvestment. If they're renting the money back to the U.S., they're not benefiting from a lower tax rate. They're going to pay the same rates we do. The other way restaurant companies have lower tax rates is from higher utilization of jobs tax credits, which we do whatever we can, but our corporate store mix is much smaller than some other companies. But if you're using a master franchise model like we are and you're repatriating the royalties, you will not be paying a lower tax rate than we are.
Yeah, because I think Burger King is similar. I thought there was a similar master franchisee model, or is that different?
Burger King also has some very big investments directly overseas. That's where you can have a benefit. But it can't come out of that. The master franchisee is paying the royalties. It's not an active, you know, that's got to come back to the U.S. That's going to get taxed.
Yeah, it's not like we have factories on the ground that we're, you know, continuing to invest a lot of CapEx, and we're very, obviously, CapEx-light, but it's all investment-light.
But Burger King does have some of the countries where they, you know, they're acting as the master franchisee. That's where you have an opportunity to do something different than we do.
But if you figure out a way to lower it for us, please let us know. our CEO and the board ask the same question from time to time.
Yeah. Fast casual is especially pizza. It seems like they're just popping up everywhere. Are they impacting your business, or do they take more share from casual dining in general?
At this point in time, we think that they're probably having more impact on either pizza competitors that are heavily lunch, sit down, carry out, very urban, or other restaurants. We don't think they're having a lot of impact on us right now. I think our sales certainly give us reason to think that. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't be paying attention to what they do. And we're certainly trying to make sure that as we run our business, we're taking into account, you know, whatever our customers think is important, and fast casual is doing a little bit of that. One of the things that people like is the ability to see their product being made, to see the ingredients, to see, you know, to have more openness. And, you know, we're doing things like that as we change the image of our stores, you know, because the consumer says that's what they want. We're going to try and respond to it. But we don't think we're having a lot of impact right now. But we want to make sure that we don't leave ourselves, you know, wide open for, you know, to be vulnerable.
What could you do to protect yourself from the fast casual pizza guys like Blaze and others?
Well, the one thing about their product is that it's hard to turn that. The product that cooks really fast doesn't deliver really well. So there's kind of a barrier there to start with. So that's one thing. The other is, you know, we've been working to build our lunch business over the last few years. We've had a fair amount of progress as we changed the menu a little bit. We still are trying to build awareness with our customers in many places that we're even open for lunch. We're just not necessarily top of mind. And when you start buying from us from lunch, and it's like you start to remember, oh, yeah, they're a really good value, and I can have it delivered. That's not all bad. So we've got some things we can work at there as well.
But what's your day part mix, just lunch and dinner in general in the U.S.?
Lunch, you're probably looking – in lunch for us, we define as, you know, goes well into mid-afternoon. Depends on the stores, can probably range anywhere from 25 to 30-35%. And then you have a dinner, and then we go all the way into late night with another fairly good piece of business. But lunch, yeah, lunch is worth being open. It's good for us. Our franchisees make money, but it is not a, it's never been the biggest piece of our business. Because delivered pizza typically is not meant for one, and it's not, it's more of a group, it's typically a little more of a group setting.
Is it fair to say that the lunch day part hasn't seen that much of a digital penetration compared to dinner?
I think it's probably seen as much. The difference is, the bigger difference between digital for us has been carry out and delivery. And delivery, if you're a delivery customer, you're more likely today to gravitate towards technology than our carry out customers have been. Some of our foreign markets, particularly Australia, it's been different. And we think with what we're seeing, it's possible that that's starting to change, but it may be a little early to make to state that as for sure. But I think there's just a bigger difference there than there is on day part.
To go back to the international business for a second, you talked about China unit economics getting better. Is there a way to think about, like, by market or in a typical market, like what the unit level cash flow needs to be, or, you know, the penetration of stores or something like that to, you know, so when you really see an inflection in the growth?
Yeah, I mean, one of the more simple ways that we like to think about it, even when we engage with our franchisees in discussions, is we typically look for a cash-on-cash return, you know, in the four-wall economics of a store, in the neighborhood of 3 years or better, to be really kind of a tipping point to get more stores built. So, in other words, just, again, very simply, but thinking about cash flow, EBITDA out of the four walls, kind of including the manager versus the CapEx to build that store. So, you know, in the U.S. where you're looking at $250,000 to $350,000 of CapEx to build a new store. You know, all of the things being equal, a 3-year payback would be about that $100,000 of EBITDA level. And when you take that internationally, of course, you have places like London where they cannot build it for $300,000. It's definitely higher, but they are having higher average cash flows coming in, so they're still able to do kind of that ratio of 3 years. I think the other thing we've seen is we've seen some places internationally that have accelerated that 3-year payback, some to 2 years. We've even had times where they've pressed a 1-year payback. You know, they put in an amount of CapEx and they're getting that out within, you know, 12 months or 18 months. In those areas, those are where we're seeing, obviously, you know, incremental growth above kind of what we would normally expect. And of course, we would expect it as finance professionals, you know, the return is very, very good. We don't have to ask those franchisees to open up the stores. They're going to open them as fast as they can because they're great investments. So we're really focused on the dialogue with our franchisees. Obviously, we get paid on the top line from a royalty on top line sales, but we've been very disciplined, I think, especially over the last 5 years plus, not only in the U.S. but internationally, to make sure that those economics, you know, the cash-on-cash returns really work, because that's where we're going to see the unit growth really start to accelerate.
There are more opportunities to reduce the G&A over time. If you look back the past few years, G&A has come down every year, and just curious what your thoughts are if you look at some of your other benchmarks versus your peers. And, you know, there's still, seems like there's still some more room to go, but talk about the opportunity of reducing G&A over time and how you get there and where are the biggest buckets coming from.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think on G&A first, you know, with any kind of metric in our business, you got to be careful on what metric you choose to kind of compare G&A dollars to. So a lot of folks look at it and they say, well, let me take G&A dollars to our revenue dollars. But, you know, our revenue dollars really get skewed because of that $1 billion revenue supply chain business, and you can really kind of get some goofy metrics and movement. One of the things about, you know, our company that's a little unique is that some of our primary sales-driving investments get classified in G&A for GAAP purposes. So, for example, our IT function, obviously driving the innovation, the point of sale, the e-commerce, all of the tack-on to our digital platform, most all of those expenses are getting classified in G&A, but yet it's really driving, that's helping to drive that. You don't get a 14.5 top line without kind of making those G&A investments. So while we've seen some leverage there, and you can expect to see some of that, the other thing I'll tell you is it's really inseparable from kind of the outperformance on the top line AWS that you see. So we're, I think our CEO said it very clearly, we believe that investing in things, particularly around IT, which does get classified in G&A, really critical for us, really strategic for us. I think you're going to see us continue to put, you know, a good amount of dollars there. As far as the other things where you think of the normal G&A spend, you know, the guy to my right, you know, he is not a guy who wastes money. So you think about G&A, you think about HR getting fat or finance getting fat in these back office areas. That's not happening here. You know, we have just as many people in finance as we did 5 years ago. So we're getting the leverage there, but I think you're going to continue to see the G&A investment in areas like marketing, data analytics, IT, e-commerce. It just so happens to get categorized in that G&A. So, you know, I think that's what you'll see going forward.
The labor environment seems to be a little bit tighter with the economy being a little bit healthier. Do you find that your either your company-owned stores, your franchise stores are having a harder time getting labor? Is there higher turnover? Is there any impact to the stores?
Because of the fact that the stores, the volume was up so much in Q4 and Q1, and certainly the franchisees and our corporate stores are out there trying to find people. Is it really harder? A little harder to say when you're just flat out looking for more people either way. But we are certainly in a hiring mode, and that's at the store level, and it's also, you know, even in our supply chain. I mean, I'm kind of temporarily been involved in that. And you know, would I like to find more drivers? And the answer is yes, and there's a lot of competition out there for them. So we know it's certainly a tighter labor market, but it's not given us undue headaches so far.
On the U.S. business, going back to that, so, I mean, if you look at the past few years, your franchisee unit economics have dramatically improved. Cash on cash, sales to investment ratio, and whatnot, and then you're also seeing that the unit growth starting to accelerate in the past few years. Is your expectation that you think that the domestic franchisee unit growth will accelerate even more going forward, so maybe of a mid-single-digit rate versus a low-single-digit rate, given how well you guys are doing and how happy they are?
I'm sorry, you just tailed off on the last half of what you said.
Sorry, the question was, do you think that the domestic franchise unit growth will accelerate to more of a mid-single-digit rate versus a low-single-digit rate, just given how well you're doing today, and I'm sure the franchisees are very happy with the recent performance. Will that accelerate unit openings in the U.S.?
Certainly, the franchisees have the financial capability, and I think the financial success over the last couple of years has made them a lot more interested in growing. We're also, you know, very willingly participating in a complete reimage program, which takes a lot of their effort as well. But you know, you've seen, it's been modest, but you've seen a steady improvement in the number of openings. And given their results, it's certainly reasonable to expect that. But you know, I'm expecting that we're going to see some of that. How much remains to be seen.
Can you give us a little bit more color on the pizza theater concept, reimaging, and I guess it's going to be, like you said, about a few points could help, but I guess overall it's going to help the brand of the company, and you need that to continue the momentum.
Yeah, the pizza theater reimage, I think it's could be characterized real well out of the gate here. We now have several thousand units around the globe that are already pizza theater image. Obviously, every new store in international has, for the last 3 years or so, have been pizza theaters. So that's helping to get us that higher adoption rate on reimage overall more quickly. The pizza theater reimage builds on a lot of the things that every other restaurant in QSR, is buying similar research. It's about bringing the operations to the front. Being more transparent, which certainly aligns with who we are as a brand, and allowing the customer to see that, it's not a factory in the back where you don't know what's going on. You can see the fresh dough. Not all of our competitors have fresh dough. You can see it being stretched. You can see it being topped. And we believe, particularly as, the long-term shift to a little bit more carryout in our stores, having that brighter and more inviting environment for a carryout customer is also important. But again, I think it's hitting on all the trends that most people see out there. I think the good part for us is that, we decided to launch this as we were on an upswing with our brand and as you mentioned with unit economics. Our franchisees, both in the U.S. and abroad, have really embraced it. They're really excited about it. So there are lots of hammers being swung even as we kind of speak right now. The long-term benefit of the reimage, as Mike said, the short-term, maybe isn't a ton. I think as you see complete markets and complete countries being done, I think we're optimistic and hopeful that, we might see a little bit more. But I'll also tell you that if you don't do a reimage program with some of the tired assets we had, particularly in the U.S. and some foreign countries, the comparison wouldn't be are you up, X percent versus flat. It would be how much are you up versus being 5 or 10% down because the image got so bad. So I think that the timing for us is very good. The franchisees are excited about it. And I'm really looking forward to, 2017, where substantially all the stores around the globe will be with the new pizza theater image. And, while that seems far away, 2017 will be here before we know it. And I think that's good for our brand long term.
Just talk about So a third of the debt you can prepay without penalty, I think, in October this year. Can you just talk about what your current thinking is around that and also opportunities to lever back up to a higher level? Just talk about that in general. What's your current thoughts?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, you know, you're right on. Of our $1.5 billion of fixed ABS, asset-backed securitization notes, our debt, one-third of it, approximately $550 million, is callable at par without a penalty in October of 2015. The rest is callable at par in July of 2017. So, you know, as we think about our capital structure, you know, we definitely were one of the QSR restaurants who kind of pioneered a little bit of a higher leverage profile. We've done it very successfully, you know, in 1998, 03, 07, 2012. We've also used it to return some substantial amounts of cash back to our shareholders. As we sit here today, you know, we're just under four turns of debt to EBITDA as we think about our business in total. We told the marketplace that, you know, anywhere between 3 and 6 times, we're certainly more than comfortable being in that range. So we're kind of in that middle to a little bit of the middle lower level of that range. What I can tell you is we continue to stay very close to what the market is doing, particularly because if we were to go out and refinance the 550 in October or at a later date or even tack on some additional, it has to be a securitization because you can't have a non-securitization tacked onto a securitized debt. So we remain very close to what's going on in the marketplace. And, you know, the good news for us is we're within the range. So we're comfortable within the range that we're at. We continue to see what the market's doing with rates and capacity. And, you know, we're going to keep our eyes open on it. But the good news for us is we have flexibility. I think we could, you know, potentially go either way. You know, time will tell.
Any last questions? Good. Thank you very much for the time. It's been really helpful.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you very much.